Blog Talk Radio. All through this storm and sleepless night, I hear my head was talking. Oh, God, save me out of my life. Out of my life.
It is Friday, March the 7th, 2014. I'm Michael Lawson, and this is The Last Word, and I am sorry for the mix-up. I wanted to play my other song. I was up till 5:30 in the morning, and I didn't load it into the sync. So we started out playing the song I wanted to end the song the day with. But you know what I'm going to do, because I know there's people out there listening who want to hear this song. So I'm going to play it for them anyway, and I'll play it at the end of the show also. Here it goes.
Back again, hurting me more and more. Maybe
That is for you know who, and I'm telling you, 1965, the year before I went into the military, what a swinging year that was. I want to tell you. I'm telling you, I'm going to play that again at the end of the show. I mean, I remember a going away party that I had. Oh, unbelievable. Yep. But I was sick before the day before I went away in the military. February 1st, 1966. Had to get in a term, 6 months, 8 months delay. But anyway, we had a going away party that was a going away party, let me tell you. And the brothers Isley were swinging. All those out there that remember 1965, that was for you. I have to say, 1962 to 1967 and 1968 were the greatest times of my life, but the best times were 62 to 65, 3 years, and I mean, it seemed like it was a century. There's so much stuff that I did with my gang, but it was fabulous. But we're now in 2014, and all the races that could come up of the ground and out of the Senate and out of the Congress have exposed themselves. And we got 7 senators that voted against a young man who would have been one of the best defenders of civil rights in this country. 47-year-old man named Debo Adjabil. He was rejected this week by the Senate, 47 to 52. We had defectors, 7, on the Democratic side. Now, Harry Reid didn't take the right count. They thought they could get it through. But that's not the point here. This man defended a person that was a convicted cop killer, defending him. He just redid the brief asking for a new trial. He wasn't the original lawyer on this. He was asked to defend someone that killed a cop. Everybody knew this. Everybody knew this. He's a lawyer that has defended, that has had going in front of the Supreme Court twice. I guarantee you there's not but 2 or 3 heads of the Civil Rights Division. Maybe not even 2 or 3. He might be the only one that's ever gone in front of the Supreme Court, who was head of the civil, who became later became head of the Civil Rights Division. Now, what does this mean to you? Don't give me this garbage. Well, he defended a cop killer, so we can't have him the head of the Civil Rights Division. That's garbage. If you're freaking Charles Manson, you deserve the best defense for you, because in this country, unless someone has seen you do the crime, you are innocent. Even then, when someone has seen you do the crime, you are presumed innocent until found guilty. Now, this is a reason why we can't have anybody in the federal government. Well, we've had Supreme Court chiefs who have done the same thing. And you know who lately did that? The latest Supreme Court chief, John Roberts. He defended a person who killed six people. Six. He wrote the briefs for the defense. He is now the Supreme Court Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So this is not about, oh, he defended a cop killer and every police precinct, every police division, every police association doesn't want him. Why didn't they put this same effort into making sure John Roberts didn't get appointed to the Supreme Court? Well, you know what the answer is? Racism. And anybody who doesn't say it is a coward. It's as simple as that. This man is good enough to go in front of the Supreme Court twice. You can count the number of lawyers, not including the Solicitor General, who have gone in front of the Supreme Court for anything, let alone twice. Getting back to what is going on here. A racist, how can I put this? A racist mentality, even in our federal government. We have a racist mentality, even in our federal government. And if you don't believe it, just look at what happened. Our Democratic leader just a few days ago, Elijah Cummings. Just look what happened. Listen, this is just the remnants of racism. When you can stand over someone and tell them they do not have the right to speak.
Well, we have
you might not have been able to hear much of that. But yesterday, what happened was the Oversight Committee, which is chaired, of course, all the chairs are Republicans in the House because they control the House. We have in our midst, in the government, we're not talking about having a black person in charge of the Civil Rights Division. We're talking about a person who is an absolute felon. Car thief, who's in charge of the Oversight Committee in the U.S. Congress. And had his record expunged. But the facts are still there. He stole cars when he was in the military. but was able to get around it. The next day, they went out and found the car, abandoned. Couldn't check it. No fingerprint. Wiped clean. But he did it. The person whose car was stolen knows he did it and said he did it in court. When he was taken to court, they didn't have enough proof to show it. But it's the third time, and I'm going to talk about that. I got all the facts right here. But when you're in charge of committee, there's a majority, a majority leader, and there's a minority leader. When any committee has a hearing, if the majority leader, if the chair of that committee speaks, poses questions to the person that they have either subpoenaed or has come before them with their own volition, then the minority chair has the right to ask questions. 5 minutes. It's the 5-minute rule. And if he doesn't get a chance to speak, then you're in violation of the 5-minute rule. And when that moron, Darrell Issa, put his finger on the button on his desk and cut off the sound of Representative Elijah Cummings, who's the minority chair on the committee, he was in violation of the 5-minute rule because he just got through questioning Ms. Lerner, the person who took the Fifth Amendment, for 15 minutes. He knew that she was going to take the Fifth Amendment, but yet he brought her in anyway to embarrass her, so he thought, and to try to link it with the president, which he was doing for the last 9 months, 10 months, a year. And when he cut off Elijah Cummings' microphone after questioning Ms. Warner, he was in violation of the 5-minute rule. Then he rushes outside, conference in front of newspapers, that he was being slandered. No one said anything about him. And when it was brought up to Bona, Bona says, I don't see anything wrong with what he did. Oh, really? Well, he's apologized now because the Black Caucus is now seeking to remove his butt as chairman of the committee. It's too daggone late. He has already done it. He's already been involved in not giving the Democrats, the minority, their speaking, their time. Darrell Issa is such a daggone criminal, it's unbelievable. And he's got away with it his whole life. And now that he's worth close to $500 million, the richest person in the Congress houses, he thinks that he can just get away with it. He thinks he could just get away with it. Yes, he started poor. Uh-huh. But what he had in his favor was he was white. And he got all the breaks. He dropped out of high school at 17. And enlisted in the army. And he had to leave that because he could not do the job. He lied about what he was doing. He said he was on the president's detail to check bomb disposals at the World Series, President Nixon. President Nixon never went to the World Series in 71. So the man lied and has been lying his entire life. It's just amazing bit of irony that a man, when his mouth moves, lies come out. He can't help it because he's been doing it since the day he was practically born. At least he did it in high school. I mean, it was just unbelievable what he did in high school. And, yeah, hey, you got to really give it to him. He's a self-made millionaire. But as I said, to do this because he is white. No African-American could have done what he did and not been in jail. There was an investigation. I just told you about the World Series. The investigation revealed that the World Series ISA was transferred to a supply depot after that incident. And he received very poor ratings as a officer. Then he got involved in stealing another officer's Dodge Charger in 71. And when he was confronted face-to-face, the guy threatened to kill him. And magically, the car appeared the next day on the turnpike, and no charges were ever filed. Then he got a hardship discharge because his father was sick. Then, again, another incident, he was stopped driving the wrong way on a one-way street, and the police officer noticed a firearm in his glove compartment. He was charged with carrying a concealed weapon. He pleaded guilty to the charge, possession of an unregistered firearm, and was sentenced to 6 months probation and a small fine. And he says, oh, I think that record was expunged. Well, this would never happen to a black man. There's no way. And this is the man who they have in charge of the oversight committee. Then again, in 1980, ISA was again indicted for grand theft auto. According to court documents, his brother William ISA had gone to a used car dealer and offered to sell his brother's car, a 76 Mercedes sedan, while impersonating his brother with an Ohio driver's license belonging to Darrell. William was given $16,000 for the car from the dealer. Shortly after sale, Darrell reported the car stolen and told the police that he had left the title in the trunk. During the investigation, Darrell reported gave conflicting statements to whether or not he had recently obtained a replacement driver's license. The brother was indicted for grand theft. Darrell claimed he had no knowledge of his brother's impersonation and sale, while William claimed that his brother had authorized him to sell the car. As the investigation continued, Darrell went into the dealership. The car was sold and repurchased his car. A few months later, investigators dropped the charges against him. Then back in 81, Darrell crashed a truck. He was driving into another motorist's car, and according to court records, ISA told her that he did not have time to wait for the police and left the scene. The other motorist sued ISA for $20,000. They eventually settled out of court for an undisclosed amount. This is the man who's in charge. This is the man who's in charge of the Oversight Committee for the Congress, for the House. And they will not let a man with a perfect record in Congress? Are you kidding me? This is just outrageous. It is outrageous. It is completely outrageous. What do we do about this? I blame all the people who in the 60s, especially in the South, who had dogs sicked on them, fire hoses turned on them, and they never taught their children what it meant to struggle. Right now, ladies and gentlemen, this is a major, major struggle. It was all hidden, this racism was hidden. In 65. Yes, some of it came out. But you see, the problem is now, it's not everybody. People did not do their diligence, and they let these people, these mongrels, as Ted Newton calls them, they let these mongrels get in and seep in, not at the highest level, but on the school boards, on the city councils, on the county commissions. That's what happened. And when he took over the county commissions and the city councils and the school boards, they eventually went to the state houses and the state senates and the governorships. And since they controlled all those branches of government in the cities and counties, it was just a stepping stone to get the vote to go higher. Because when they got into that Senate seat, that state Senate seat, and that state House seat, changed the laws. Now you have reaped what you sow by not going out to vote. When you had the chance to get out to vote, where there was plenty of voting places, where there was plenty time to vote, you took your time and decided, because you had a black president, that there's going to be a chicken in every pot. And not only African Americans thought this, whites thought this also. Things have changed. We have a black president. But you see, here's the problem. You all don't remember your civics lesson and don't remember Schoolhouse Rock, because the President of the United States does absolutely nothing when it comes to getting and writing a law. It's the House that writes the law, not the Senate. It's the House that writes the law. Yes, sometimes the Senate might write a bill, but it's got to go to the House for approval. Yes, also that works the other way. When the Senate writes the law, they have to go and send that to the Senate to be approved, and then signed by the president. But we have fallen asleep to switch. Now we want to turn that switch on, and we find that the wires at the electrical box have been disconnected. Let's see who we have on the line here. Hello there, caller. Who's this? Hello, caller.
My God, it's Dave Adams. I'm just listening in.
Oh, okay. That's all right. We have a major problem developing, listeners. People have come out of the woodwork and have taken over your government because you were asleep at the switch. A lot of people just said, well, you know, it's not happening to me. I'm white. Ain't happening to me. But these people don't care if you're white. These people only care about what they want to do with this country. You know, I had a quotation last week, 2 weeks ago. I'd rather reign in hell than serve in heaven. And I was told by a young lady that was kind of harsh. But you know what? It ain't harsh. Because that's exactly what this regressive Republican mongrel party is doing. They don't care about the Republican Party. They don't care about the Democratic Party. They don't care about the American people. They would rather reign in hell than serve in heaven. And their job is to destroy the Constitution. No matter what they say, their job is to destroy the Constitution and redo it in their own image. And if that means they lose 70, 60, 80% of the Republican Party that's in power now, they would do it. They would destroy the Republican Party and have 90% Democrats running everything than to have a two-party system. But you see, the problem is, if you don't have a two-party system, you don't have a daggone country, because you can't give one party all that power, because they will revert to what we have now, but tenfold worse. We need a two-party system, but the Cruises and the kings of this country want to destroy this party. And there is a there's this guy called Paul Weinrich, who sums it up in his own inimitable way. Just listen to this.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
I mean, hey, what can you say? What can you say after hearing that? Paul Weinrich, who is the father of the conservative movement, they don't want everybody to vote. They can't win if everybody votes. Their whole thing is to get nobody to vote, just them. They want people to get so disgusted, forget it. There's nothing I can do about it. Well, that's a bunch of crap. You can do something about it. And I saw a movie one time, and I can't think of the star. They went back in time. And it's not the time machine. It was another one. But the people were all, you know, they were just going along with, you know, they had no ambition, they just, you know, just went along with everything that was going on. And the guy, the star, he said, look, what the hell is wrong with you people? You have to get up and fight, even if some of you die. As a matter of fact, they did a copy of it on Star Trek. People don't realize when you give away your rights without protest, 90% of the time you ain't getting them back. You're not going to get it back. So where are we at right now? We're in a major hurt. That's where we're at right now. We're in a major hurt because I understand that ISA has apologized. But let me just play this one thing for you here.
I regret this question, but if you will sit down and allow me to ask a question, I am a member of the Congress of the United States of America. I am tired of this.
Well,
we have members over here. Each who represents 700,000 people. You cannot just have a one-sided investigation. There is absolutely something wrong with that, and it is absolutely un-American.
Hear, hear.
Our chairman led the charge, saying this was, quote, targeting of the president's political enemies, end of quote. The chairman certainly did not withhold judgment. He rushed to it with no evidence whatsoever. The responsible answer is that we have no evidence at all to back up that claim.
Well, I have never said that it was the president. I've never said that he directed it.
He's a liar. I told you, every time ISA opens his mouth, when it's moving, he's lying. Even if he's mumbling, he's lying. He has this whole thing was started. He came out before the first meeting of the Oversight Committee, before the first person was asked. He came on national television and he says, I have seen the evidence, and it goes right into the White House. So what is this man talking about?
During your transcribed interview with the committee staff, you were asked this question: are you aware of any political bias by employees in the Cincinnati office against Tea Party organizations? And you responded, no, quote, no, I am not. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, that is correct.
And you still stand by that?
Yes, sir.
You also asked this question, quote, are you aware of any political motivations behind the development and screening and grouping of Tea Party cases? And the quote, and again you responded, quote, no, I am not. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, that is correct.
And is your testimony the same today?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so based on your own personal experience, did you ever receive direction from anyone in the White House concerning your handling of the Tea Party applications?
No, sir, I did not.
You know, we heard exactly the same thing from every, just to let you know, we heard the same thing that you just said from every single person we interviewed, 16 of them, of you all. So I don't understand why this keeps, these allegations keep propping up.
The whole thing was, you have the right to take the Fifth Amendment, and you have the right to have a lawyer defend you, whether it's in the district court or the Supreme Court. I don't care if you shot 100 people. We have a case right now in Franklin County. We got a young man in jail for almost 2 years without a court damn date. I mean, what are we talking about? You talk about not racist. He's black. Let me tell you that. Or did you have to guess? Almost 2 years. No court date. Nada. Let me read you something. The Sixth Amendment of the Constitution is part of the Bill of Rights, and it sets forth rights related to criminal prosecution and the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. Criminal defendants have the right to a speedy trial. That was in Barker versus Wingo. 407, U.S. 514, 1972, Supreme Court. You have the right, the length of delay, a delay of a year or more from the date on which a speedy trial right attaches, whichever comes first, was presumptively prejudicial by the court and never explicitly ruled that any absolute time limit applies. Reason for delay. Prosecution may not excessively delay a trial to its own advantage, but a trial may be delayed to secure the presence of an absent witness or other practical consideration. Time and manner in which the defendant has asserted his right. If a defendant agrees to delay when it works to his or her advantage. Do you understand that? Time and manner in which a defendant has asserted his or her right. If the defendant agrees to the delay which works to his or her benefit, he cannot later claim that he has been unduly delayed. So what does that mean? That means if the defendant wants to delay the trial, not the prosecutor, the defendant, because a defendant is presumed innocent. Let me give you a for instance here. Trump versus the U.S., 412 U.S. 434, 1973, the Supreme Court ruled that if the reviewing court finds that a defendant's right to a speedy trial was violated, then the indictment must be dismissed and or the conviction overturned. The court held that since the delayed trial is the state action which violates the defendant's rights, no other remedy would be appropriate. Thus, a reversal or dismissal of the criminal case on a speedy trial grounds means that no further prosecution for the alleged offense can take place. That's what that means. We have a young man, Franklin County, almost 2 years. I mean, he ain't the only one in this country. And the only reason why we even know about that, because he has advocates. If he didn't have any advocates for him, he would be buried in that jail. And we would not even know. We have some calls here. Let me see who's here. Hello, who's this?
Michael, this is Randy Roller. How you doing?
How are you doing, Randy? What's the story? Tell us.
Sorry,
what's
the
going
weather
on?
Is miserable, and my dogs are barking and working nonstop.
I understand you were at a conference in Washington.
I was.
And ladies
I
gentlemen,
was at
Randy Roller.
Yeah.
Let me introduce this Randy Voller. He's the chairman of the Democratic Party of North Carolina.
Well,
so
thank
ahead,
you
Randy.
For having me on, Michael. I was up there at the DNC ASTC meeting, and Vice President Biden and President Barack Obama addressed the DNC, the first time I had seen that ever happen. It was pretty memorable.
Yes. Absolutely. Now, what do you think the reason why they came?
Excuse me?
What do you think the reason why both of them came?
Well, at first, they had scheduled for Barack Obama, and then a couple days later, we got this notice that the vice president was coming, and I think that the vice president spoke to the National Association of State, County Chairs, Vice Chairs, and, you know, executive directors, and then the president spoke to the entire DNC.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, Biden's message was a strong message about our values and that, you know, we can't let Republicans run away from their record.
Right.
The president gave, you know, a soaring address about, you know, what's at stake for us in the 2014 elections and how we got to come together, and he got everyone inspired. Donna Brazile was there too, of course, Debbie Washington Schultz, I mean, all those folks. But I thought both, you know, the president and vice president did a great job of kind of laying out what's coming ahead and what we need to do. But it's amazing how this battle nationwide is just so complicated, and, you know, and we're just dealing with forces here that are so well-funded, they can repeat a lie over and over again until people just believe it.
Right. And joining us right now, Mr. Chairman, is Dr. Benjamin Chavis. Doctor, how are you?
I'm doing fine. So good to be back on your show. And Randy, how are you?
I'm doing great, Ben. It's another beautiful day in paradise down here.
Well, I love North Carolina, so I'm sure that the weather will improve in the next 24 hours. And looking forward to the meeting on Sunday of the Executive Council of the North Carolina Democratic Party.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that too. Well, I have you both on. Ben, I'd like to ask you, Dr. Chavis, I'm sorry, but what do you see? I was talking about before you got on about how the voting populace in this country are really to blame for where we are today with who's in power. Because they had not paid attention to the little things, and I don't want to make it belittle the little things, but saying the education, the boards of education, and the county commissioners, and the city council races, which produced all these people, when these people just took over all that and took over the county, then next step was to move into the state offices, and then into the governorship, and then to change all the laws that they could, voting and otherwise. Well, what do you say about that, Dr. Jevons?
Well, thank you. It's a very good question. I'm going to start by saying democracy, by definition, means it's participatory. If you don't participate in a democracy, if you don't vote, if you don't get involved in civic engagement, that's what the term means. You have to engage the process, not observe it, not witness it. You have to jump in and make sure your interests are spoken to, your interests are voted on, and your interests are fulfilled. I think sometimes we wait for career politicians to solve problems. But problems are solved when people are organized at the grassroots, when people are mobilized at the grassroots. And out of that grassroots struggle, the city merged the people who get to be elected. A lot of times right now, people get elected based on who's got the most money. It has nothing to do with coming out of a struggle of people who have raised aspirations and raised expectations. I consider myself a progressive Democrat, and by definition, that means that I have to do something to bring more people into the Democratic Party to help make things get better, you know. And I think that that is why we need to work hard with Cameron Randolph Lawler to make sure that the Democratic Party is representative of the interests of the constituency that has been historically marginalized, has been historically left out, and then generate resources. Because I think that it's interesting that African Americans spent over $1 trillion in the last 12 months in the American economy. But what we spend our money on has very little to do with public policy, has very little to do with who gets elected, has very little to do we're mainly consumers, and what we consume sometimes is not in our best interest. So to answer your question, and specifically in North Carolina, I believe that there's a tremendous potential to expand the base of the Democratic Party, of not only minorities, but progressive whites, and then to, out of that milieu, have the upcoming and emergence of accountable elected officials at the school board level, at the county commissioner level, at the city council level, at the congressional level, at the mayoral level. And then we can have good people to run for governor, for lieutenant governor, for the United States senator, and because right now we have an inverted process where money alone dictates, and this is what happened with the state legislature in North Carolina. There are more Democrats in North Carolina than Republicans. So how is it that we now have a Republican governor, Republican Senate control, and Republican House control? There's something wrong with that formula. That's not good mathematics.
Well, see, you took my next question right out of my mouth, Dr. Javis, because I was going to ask that to Randy. How do we, for 125 or even 140 years, Democrats, when I say we, control the House, Senate, the governorship most of the time, and, you know, the Senate most of the time? How do we now lose all of this in a time, and this is my whole thing, where we had a black president? Because as far as I'm concerned, this is a racial issue. Because none of this happened until we had a black president. None of it. And if we don't put our mind to that fact, we're crazy.
I was on the phone earlier today with Michael Evans, who was your former party chair in Mecklenburg back in 2003 to 2007, I believe.
Correct.
and he had worked on the campaigns when Erskine Bowles ran in 2002 and then in 2004. There had been an attenuation in the state before Barack Obama got elected, and in fact, due to demographic changes and, you know, kind of a push with the Nixon strategy of, you know, 68, that you already saw, you know, this movement, as you know, Michael, of these Southern Democrats, these Dixiecrats, you know, based on values toward the Republican Party. And consequently, I think the weaknesses that we've seen, you know, they started, you know, decades ago. I mean, for instance, one of mutual friends of Ben and I, Michael Carmichael, talks about the election in 1984 for governor when there was a very competitive primary, and that was at a time that typically the Democrat would emerge as the victor. And Eddie Knox, the mayor of Charlotte, was a more conservative Democrat, a business Democrat, really, and he ended up getting on board and supporting Ronald Reagan in 84 and changing party affiliation and supporting Jim Martin. And part of that was due to money. The Republicans always have money. And from what I understand, there were campaign debts. And just, I'm getting this all, you know, third hand, but it's not unusual. You know, people help to raise money to pay it off, and he shifted. So you've got lots of stories like that where people that are in that middle ground, the business community, they move their allegiances on the basis of what they might get out of the democratic process. So I agree with you that it's been, you know, particularly acute with the election of Obama, but the underlying structural reasons for this started a long time ago.
Well, yeah, and you might be right on that, but sitting there looking, I mean, it seemed to be such a major, major drop-off. I mean, it's like dropping off the side of a mountain. And the thing is that, to me, a lot of people, I believe, African-Americans especially, Dr. Davis, believe that with the election of Barack Obama, there was going to be a chicken in every pot. What do you say about that?
Well, first of all, it was a great achievement for Barack Obama to occur in North Carolina in 2008.
You know that.
But keep in mind, what happened in 2010 and what happened in 2012 was, in fact, a reaction.
Yes.
You know, where there was a negative reaction to the election of the first African-American as president of the United States, no question about it. And you would have thought that the fact that the Democrats brought the convention to Charlotte in 2012, that if there was any state that would have the tradition of what started in 2008, it should have been North Carolina. But what Randy has alluded to is correct. I mean, money, you know, money is not Democrat or Republican. Money is money. And I think that there's an opportunity for Democrats to get financial funding and financial sustainability as well. I wouldn't send money to the Republicans. I think the money will flow where money thinks the movement of public policy, the movement of various interest groups to influence how the state will go. And I think right now, McCrory, who's the former governor of, I'm the former mayor of Charlotte, now he's the governor of North Carolina, I think they've taken the state so far to the right. I also believe that in 2014, and this is the job that the NCDP has to do now, is to mobilize the counter-reaction to the backwardness, to the right-wing policies. We have more people in poverty now in North Carolina than ever before, more people without health care than ever before. The public school system is not adequately funding. The university system is not adequately funding. I mean, I could just go down. Organized labor needs to respond to the conditions of people. President Obama was in Connecticut yesterday with several governors talking about raising the minimum wage to $10.10. I think that there are real life and death issues, real quality and death issues, quality of life issues, Michael, that I think that the people will respond. I think there's a weather war. You started out talking about why people are allowing things to happen. Well, if you don't vote, you do allow things that will happen against your interests. All your listeners, Michael, they should understand fundamentally that the right to vote is not just a privilege, it is a necessity. We cannot have a participatory democracy where hundreds of thousands of North Carolinians sit back and complain about what is going on, but don't go to the polls and vote.
Well, you know, joining us right now is Dr. Grace Lynn Galloway. Dr. Galloway, how are you?
Hello, Michael. Hello, Dr. Ben Chavis, and hello, Mr. Chairman.
Hello. How are you doing? Always good. And if we had more district chairs like Dr. Grace Galloway, Michael, the North Carolina Democratic Party would be in much better shape.
Oh, I doubt about that. Dr. Galloway, with the redistricting, because I was in the 8th district, one time chair, one time vice chair, and now I'm redistricting out to the 12th district, what change have you seen in the way your 8th congressional district is aligned as far as voting?
Well, first, instead of 10 counties, we have 12.
Right.
We have more partial counties at this point in time. But as far as, here's a peculiar thing, which was an unintentional consequence, I believe, of what the Republicans did when they redistricted, is that we actually have quite a higher majority of minorities within the district. Now, not registered to vote, mind you, but minorities that live in our district. So the key, of course, would be to get all of them registered to vote and engaged, which is something that Dr. Chavis is brilliant at. I mean, he knows how to do that, I believe, in his sleep, because, you know, this is a man who brought the Crips and the Blood, those two gangs in Los Angeles, together. And my gosh, if you can bring the Crips and the Blood together, you can, as far as I'm concerned, the man walks on water. Dr. Chavis walks on water. You know.
Well,
so,
you see, the thing is, how many minorities are now in the 8th congressional district that weren't in? What's the difference between the when we had the 12 to the 10, but now we have more minorities, you're saying?
We have more. Actually, we do. By census figures, we actually have more minorities. Yeah. We have over 40% that are African American. And then if you throw in the Native Americans, now that's going to be a tough nut to crack. But if we can bring if you throw in the Native Americans, the Hispanic Americans, and Asian Americans, we actually are tipping close to 50% of minorities. So if we go by the traditional metric that the African American vote has a tendency to vote 98% Democratic, you know, and then if you look at the Hispanic vote, which also tends to be a majority Democratic, and the Asian vote, which is strongly Democratic, then you're talking about really, even though we may not be more than 50%, we're actually talking about a majority minority in the 8th district. So it's, you know, again, an unintended consequence of their redistricting, but thank you. So we'll take it.
Well, so what you're saying is that even though it was redistricted to kill the Mecklenburg County part of that 8th district. What we have right now, are you saying that we can put somebody else up to run in that district and we could win?
We have a great opportunity to flip this district, yes.
That'll be a great turnaround, Michael. To me, that's the way. See, we're not going to reverse what's going on in Raleigh with the flip of a light switch. It's going to take some time. But where we start is in places like what Dr. Galloway, where she represents. We can take that congressional district and not only take the congressional seat, but take all the other seats, the school board, the county commissioner, city council. We can either go down the line. Democrats should leave nothing standing. We have to overwhelm the opposition. I'm not for winning votes by one or two votes. We have to have a response from the people who are hurting. And there are more North Carolinians that are hurting today as a result of these Republican policies than ever before. And we have to translate that hurt into votes. We have to translate that hurt into mobilization. We have to translate that hurt into raising money. There's money in our communities. We're not as poor as we think we are. Poverty is a relative thing. We just spend our money on the wrong things.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chairman, what do we need to win in the county? How many more do we need to win? Because, you know, nobody votes at 100%. And I think we're voting at, 33%, something like that. How much more of a turnout do we need?
First of all, what we need is that our base and like-minded unaffiliates that support us need to vote in every election year. That includes congressional and municipal, so that we're voting at a level like we do in a presidential. If we were just to simply do that, we wouldn't have any problems winning these elections. Number two, some of these counties where there's a potential for upping the vote, as Ben was describing, like Cumberland County, we need those counties to be trained and be organized so that they actually are getting numbers closer to Chatham County or Durham or Orange County or Wake. If Cumberland had voted at the level, for instance, that Chatham did in terms of percentage of turnout last election cycle, Linda Coleman would be lieutenant governor. Because they have the numbers, but their performance level is significantly lower in terms of percentage of turnout. And that's why I've been telling elected officials, people running for office, that the simplest investment they could make is invest their fundraising operations into building county parties. If the county party has money in its treasury and the county party is able to mobilize their volunteers, you're going to win the elections. But the problem with that strategy is it doesn't pay a lot of money to consultants and other folks that can't see a pathway to profit by doing that. Now, I'm not telling people they shouldn't make money. They should. I'm just saying that it's a strategy in mobilization that requires basically work on the county level, and it requires a plan, but it does not necessarily require a lot of advertising on TV. Generally speaking, if Kay Hagan really wants to win, she has to have an air war, which is your media, targeted media campaigns, and a ground war. And right now, it's not clear that she's winning the air war, because she's obviously not on the air, and she's getting hammered by C4 advertisements. But on the ground game, she could invest in these county operations in these congressional districts and actually win, and I would advise that that's what she should do.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to win the skirmishes in order to win the battle. Right now, we have somebody else joining us right here. Hello, who's this? Hello? 004, who's this? Well, I guess they just want to listen. Anyway, the thing is that our strategy then is to take what we have and just increase it, which is what you should do all the time. But how do you get people to understand that by not voting, they're actually voting for the other side? Dr. Chavis, you take that.
Yes, well, I think, you know, over the last 50 years, I've learned a few things about consciousness raising the awareness, raising the consciousness. And what I mean by that, we have to think about politics not just at election time.
Right.
It amazes me how, you know, people run up for office, show up at black churches a few weeks before the election, and then after the election, you never see them. I think that we have to have a consistent political awareness, political consciousness raising among young people, among millennials, among the African-American caucus, the Asian-American caucus, the Hispanic caucus, and the Progressive caucus. I would like to go to each of the 100 counties on behalf of each caucus in the Democratic Party and build a base. from the mountains to the shore. Don't leave any county untouched. We have to out-organize. We have to out-mobilize. And as you know, being on the radio, there's a lot of merit to consistency. The message has to be consistent, but the message also has to be drilled in our mindset repeatedly, because unfortunately, we live in a society where there are a lot of diversions, where people get their attention diverted. And I think that given the tragic occurrences over the last few years in North Carolina in terms of the decrease in the quality of life of millions, I'm talking about over a million people are hurting. But we need those million votes now to respond consistently, as Dr. Galloway, as Randy has said, at the county level and everything in the county, at the district level. And we can turn this around. I am not a pessimist. I'm optimistic. I know we can do it, but it requires us to roll up our sleeves. And I'll just say this on the record. Democrats got to stop some of the infighting. We're fighting one another. We should be fighting the Republicans. I think it's awful. It's sinful.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But you know, I can say you're right, that, but that's the Democratic Party. It's been like this forever. I mean... We're always fighting one another. The thing is, right, you know, that's because we're not homogenous. Well, we're diverse. And we have different things we need to bring to the table. The Republicans
right, Michael,
don't have such. Yes.
Right. Michael, this is Gracie Galloway. Now, listen, I agree that we are diverse, but having an honest debate is very different than having what is going on right now, which is an all-out, absolute, slanderous, you know, it's a war that we're fighting huge, ginormous battles within our own ranks. An honest debate is one thing, but this fighting, the slander, the even libelous statements, the finger-pointing, the accusations, that's not what the Democratic Party is all about. The Democratic Party is about honest debate. It is about big tent. It's about diversity and accepting diversity and being able to have good arguments and good, you know, it's be able to do all of that sort of thing. And if we can't do it, then we don't deserve to call ourselves Democrats. And unfortunately, absolutely unfortunately, we have within our ranks people who don't understand what it means to be a leader. They don't understand it. They are the first out of the gate to point fingers and accuse. They are the first out of the gate to cause deception and be divisive. They're the first out of the gate to slander other people and then turn around and blame the victim. Okay? These people don't deserve to call themselves Democrats.
Well, you know, but then you also have this, what we had yesterday, seven senators that voted against Gillibrand's bill. We had seven senators. Now, these people are just out of their daggone mind. None of them have ever been in the military, so they don't know what they're talking about. None of them know that there is, I mean, it's like more than 5,000 rapes or gropes a year is happening. That's what's reported. So it's not only the people we're trying to get to vote. The people that we put in there are Democrats, because we should not allow that to happen.
And we know that. You know, we really actually do know that. Any thinking Democrat will agree with you and say, yes, we get it. We understand that. And many times we ask people, rightly or wrongly, to hold their nose and vote for the person anyway, because the bottom line is that ultimately we rely on their vote in order to get, you know, a specific agenda through. But what I'm talking about is when we talk about, you know, dissension within our ranks, when we talk about dissension, like, for example, you know, in the North Carolina Democratic Party, I am talking about the people, I'm talking about us Democrats being able to have, Michael, you and I have had debates. We have not always agreed, but you and I have had debates. And we leave going feeling really refreshed at the end of the debate because we, first of all, you've asked the things that have made me think and vice versa. But what is happening right now with this insanity, and I call it insanity, within the Democratic Party in North Carolina is it is unconscionable. It's reprehensible. It should never occur. People who are in leadership positions, okay, should be the last ones to go public with slander and spurious statements. They should be the first ones to be to soothe the waters, but instead they are the first ones out of the gate to point fingers, to make slanderous statements, to make slanderous statements about Dr. Chavis, to make slanderous statements about Randy Voller. They don't, you know, they're playing the Republican game where it is very easy to point a finger, but by golly, it's tough to defend because the defense is convoluted. And then when you try to defend and when you try to explain the situation, what these people who are the ones slinging the mud will say, oh, get over it. Get over it. And I have to say, wait a minute, you sling the mud, but I'm not allowed to defend?
Well, that's what Daryl Issa told Elijah Cummings the other day. I mean, but see, here's the thing. Why are they doing that so outwardly now?
Because, you know, Randy, if you don't mind, I'm going to jump in and answer. My feeling, and this is just my personal feeling, and it's based not just a gut feeling, but it's based upon research. But my explanation is a better word, is that we've got some Dixiecrats and we've got some people within the Democratic Party in North Carolina that have been so used to the way things are, the status quo, if you will. And the status quo, unfortunately, cost us not only a lot of money over the years, but also cost us the governor's mansion and the legislature, cost us the House and the Senate in Raleigh. And it cost us quite a number of congressional seats as well. But they don't want to let go of the status quo. They want to continue with that status quo. And why? The reason is because there are people within the status quo that have made money off the Democratic Party. You have consultants being paid for generations, for, I should say decades, being paid to spout the same old tired line, and the same old tired line that landed us in this mess. So now you've got a progressive person like Randy Voller who's put his neck on the line. Do you think Randy likes doing what you honestly think anybody likes being slammed every single day? Do you think anybody likes being, you know, accused of the most horrible and meanest things every single day? Nobody does. But Randy has managed to hold his head high and keep plowing along. It's not easy to do what he's done, and I am so proud of him that he is continuing to do this.
Well, you know, I am too, and I think there's a lot of people. But, Mr. Chairman, how do you look at where we are as far as, well, 214 is around the corner. So, and I hate to talk about 216, so we'll talk about 214 with Senator Kay Hagan. How does she look in this race?
Well, everyone knew coming into this race it was going to be a challenge. It's a midterm race. We know that there were two races in the United States, Louisiana and North Carolina, that were targeted as leaning either way. And so that the RNC and independent expenditure groups would be targeting Louisiana, Mary Landrieu, and North Carolina, Kay Hagan, to try to pick those seats up. So, you know, it was going to be an uphill climb from the get-go. I think that that she could win this race. She can win this race. Things could fall into her favor, but the campaign needs to coalesce around what its dominant theme is. They've been defining Tom Tillis, thinking he'll be the presumptive winner in the May primary. But, you know, the people are very, you know, are very upset about what's happened in Raleigh. And I talked to David Price about this, and he thinks that the senator needs to run this race more like a state Senate race than actually a U.S. Senate race, meaning the issues that she needs to put out there need to do with the General Assembly in the state and McCrory, and focus on their failure to accept the money that would cover 500,000 people and create 20,000 jobs, for instance, and focus on their failures that are leading the hospital shutting down. And that gets her away from defending some of these federal issues that in some parts she has no control over.
Right. Well, you know, if we have the if we're gonna put, was it 500,000 more people on the health care rolls? This can only
yes.
help the cities and the counties that have the hospital system that are breaking. I mean, what is so difficult to understand about that? And why don't people understand that? Randy?
That's a very good question. I mean, we're the only state that did a couple of these things, and it's driven by ideological concerns. I think that North Carolina, because we had been seen as the Dixie Dynamo going all the way back to the famous 1947 article, and that we had been viewed by the rest of the South as progressive relative to the South, mind you, not relative to certain other states in the country, that it made perfect sense for these type of forces, the ALEC, Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity, to double down on North Carolina and come in here and essentially use this as a laboratory for their type of legislation and prove that they can beat back any progressive impulse here and use that as a way to grow into the South and some of these Midwestern states. That's, you know, that's why we're in the fix we are now. You know, if they didn't view the state as being as important as it was, and I've said this before, Michael, and I'll say it again, they have to have North Carolina in their win column to win the presidency. They come right. into an election with 207 electoral votes. When you look at the last six presidential elections, we count on the red side because only in 08 did we vote for a Democrat. If you remove us with our 15 electoral votes and add it to the Democratic side, Democrats start with 257. We're at 272. They're at 192. Game over. They know that
right.
if North Carolina becomes Virginia, they are out of luck.
Well, the situation now is actually creeping that way, just like it's creeping in Texas. I mean, the Texas, you know, they're going to have, I believe it was like over 200,000 Hispanics eligible to vote 4 years from now. I mean, that's going to be blue. I mean, we're not talking about 2035. We're talking about maybe 216 or 220 the latest. So, you know, I gave a quote.
Oh, did I lose him?
Are you asking me or are you asking Ben? Who are you asking that question to?
No, I didn't ask.
I'm back on. This is Ben. I'm back.
Thomas is off.
Okay.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, mm-hmm. I hear you. Fine.
Great. What was the question?
Hello? No, I'm saying that we have I don't know how many it was like 200,000 people, the Hispanics in Texas, that are in 4 years are going to be eligible to vote. So you know, people were saying, "Oh, it's 235 when the state will go blue. It could go blue in 220."
Right.
So
yeah,
the
demographic change is going to benefit. I think. Diversity enriches democracy. It doesn't hamper democracy.
Right.
And I think in Texas, North Carolina, and Florida, even in South Carolina, there's going to be a lot of changes. What I'm thinking is, though, we have to prepare for those changes now. We shouldn't just be reactionary. We have to be proactive. We have to plan for the expanding the base of the North Carolina Democratic Party in places where the Republicans think that they have a solid hold. They don't. They control the state legislature by narrow margins. They control the state senate by narrow margins. I think that McCoy is going to be a one-term governor.
Oh,
and so what we have to do is to prepare for the Democratic retake of the House and the Senate and the governor's mansion. But my caution to the Democrats, and to, I'm talking to myself, is that we have to connect to the masses of people between these elections. So we don't have to wonder about whether or not they're going to come out to vote. We know that they're going to come out to vote because their consciousness has been properly raised. Their participation at the county level has been activated. So, you know, the way to build a strong statewide turnout is to have strong local and county turnout.
And
hello?
Yeah. I think we lost Michael.
No, we
haven't.
Thomas is talking. Can you hear him?
No.
No.
Can't hear you. Okay, well, hey, we'll see what happens here. Good. Go ahead. All right, talk again, Tom.
Can you all actually hear me now?
Yeah.
A little better.
Okay. So I was just saying the Koch brothers are focusing on North Carolina exactly for that reason. This is a purple state that is at risk. They know their policies are driving the electorate blue because of the 18 certification of the state and the pollution and the everything else that's been in the news lately. And that is why they are dumping boatloads of money into this state. I mean, it's unbelievable. They didn't make it every trip in a senatorial race, what they're doing on Kay Hagan. They're over, four times what they've spent anywhere. So my question is, what do we directly do to counter them? They are trying to build a fortress in North Carolina to maintain this Republican model so that then they can replicate it across the South and across the Midwest. What do we do to counter that? Because they've got all the money in the world.
Brandy, what do you think about that?
I think the only way to counter it is to actually, number one, offer good, clear programs that a majority of the people like and want and come forward and state them. For instance, the Democratic Party and our affiliates continually need to strongly state we are for clean drinking water. And the more this comes up about the fly ash ponds and the issue with Duke, the more we need to point out that to have a reasonable and rigorous regulatory framework that protects our drinking water. Obviously, we don't want to be so rigorous that we prevent people from making a profit in their business. On the other hand, we cannot put profits above people's health and above human beings. I mean, water polls about 85%. And then also, the party and our people need to clearly put forward ideas that actually can be implemented and show that we are for something. For instance, take this fly ash situation. Years ago, I held symposiums on plasma gasification. That's a technology that can actually, among other things, clean up fly ash. They know that they have problems with this because they have all these legacy plants from running coal-operated utilities. There's a whole series of issues that if we approach what we're doing on, here's our program, here's what we can do to make your community better, here's how we can make your life better, then we're not just a party that's against things and attacking Republicans. We're a party that's embracing the whole community and saying, look, we're offering solutions to make your life better. I mean, money can go far enough, but human beings talking to human beings and actually putting forth good ideas can carry the day. And you just have to do it community by community, and that's why a community organizer like Ben Chavis is so important.
I would say it this way, that we organize and mobilize the people, the money will come. If you go after the money without the people, that's very tentative. And that's why, while, yes, Republicans have the money, but they don't have the people. And we organize and mobilize the people across the state of North Carolina. Believe me, the Koch brothers won't have enough money because the people mobilized and organized properly with the strategic plan that Randy is talking about for the Democratic Party. I think the Democratic Party would be invincible. But again, once the Democrats get back in office, we have to deliver improving the quality of life of the people who vote for us. And that's a distinction between Democrats and Republicans. You know, it's just not about getting in office. It's about, once we're in office, representing the kind of public policy, kind of legislation, kind of actions, both legislative and executive actions, that improve the quality of life of the people who live in North Carolina.
Well, you're exactly right. And money doesn't make you win. We proved that when we got Larry Kissel, who ran against Robin Hayes. Or the organization in getting the people out to vote won. And then Larry Kissel saw that again when we didn't get out to vote for him. And we told him we weren't getting out to vote for him. So that does work. You're absolutely correct. And, go ahead. You were saying something, Grace? Grace?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think if we really wanted to send a message in this election cycle, we would get behind Grace Galloway and actually take a congressional district that nobody thinks you can take. We know you can take the 8. Elect Antonio Blue as the next congressperson, and you'll actually send a message that will be heard in D.C.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. Well, I have taken up too much time of you guys, but I'm going to see you on Sunday. Is there anything else you want to say, Mr. Chairman, about Sunday?
We're having our executive council meeting. We've got a number of agenda items. We'll be talking about some of the personnel items and briefing, which would include executive director. We'll be briefing our council on last year's compliance issues, and then we'll be going over some other strategic plan and business issues, and then the tax checkoff committee will meet after it. So I anticipate a good, solid business meeting to get Democrats back on the right footing going forward, and we'll subsequently we'll start having these meetings probably every 6 weeks.
Who are the members of the executive council?
There's 51 members, 46 are voting members, 5 are ex officio sustaining fund members, including Rodney Monroe and Carla Cunningham down in your neck of the woods. In fact, I think I'm going to appoint Beverly Earle to take the place of Ron Sanyal, who's running for Congress, so he has to come off the council. And then you've got your officers, your 13 congressional district chairs, your DNC members, your presidents of your auxiliaries, and then some, you know, the head of the Minority Affairs, which is Floyd McKissick, and then a few other at-large appointments like sustaining fund chairs and at-large appointments for the chair. So it adds up to 46. It covers a cross-section of Democrats in North Carolina.
Now, is this something that any Democrat can come to sit in and listen?
Yeah. The plan of organization states that any meeting is open. If you open it up, they're all open. You just can't, if we have a closed session to deal with executive council matters that would be closed, like personnel, for instance, then you'd have to leave the room. But that's no different than, you know, a county commissioner or school board or municipal meeting.
Okay. And where is this going to take place at?
The Guilford County headquarters in 2300 Meadowview, right off of I-40, across from the Corey Center.
Very good. And that's at 2 o'clock, correct?
Yes.
That's at 2 o'clock. Okay. Well, Dr. Chavis, do you have anything else you want to leave us with since we've held the hostage?
Thank you very much, and I appreciate what you do on this radio program to inform the people. I look forward to the meeting Sunday. I'm optimistic. We have a big challenge, but I know that the North Carolina Democratic Party will rise to the challenge. We are going to raise the money that's going to be necessary. But as we said in this program, you raise up the people, the money will come.
Absolutely.
Grace, Dr. Grace, what do you have for
I am simply echoing everything that Dr. Chavis and Randy has said, and I also am optimistic. I think those of you who know me know that my mantra is failure is not an option. It is not an option. So we will win this thing.
I want to thank everybody. Thank Dr. Ben Chavis and Chairman Randy Volger and Chairwoman Dr. Grace Galloway for holding you guys hostage for the last hour or so. And looking forward to see you guys on Sunday.
Very good. Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Mike, I would like to say that
yes?
Dr. Grace's point about failure is not an option. In this specific case, rework that out. 1860 is not an option.
1860 is not an option.
Because that's what...
The only problem is we don't have troops to send there. That's the only difference.
But
we don't have troops. Maybe we can get some of those secret hidden face troops that are guarding the bases in the Crimea.
Yeah.
Since they have no insignia, that means all we need to do is ask them.
What we need is a new underground river.
Oh.
Bring
from Ukraine?
North.
Oh. From
shake things up and bring our state, our beautiful state, back to the president.
Well, see, the thing is, that, and you missed my first hour rant. It was, you get what you sow.
Yes.
And if you don't sow, you still get it.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is,
yeah,
you got to sow, but you got to sow in the right direction with your glasses on.
Yeah. Well, we got the apathy vote. So look what we got.
Apathy vote? No.
Wait,
I think it's a stupid vote. They don't know nothing. Don't want to know nothing. How many people, I have gone to places, parties, associations, and you know, people I've asked, talked about, oh, no, I don't talk about that. I don't bother with any of that.
Right.
What, are you kidding me?
Yep. Well, I've also heard people say,
it don't affect you?
That's exactly. I've heard people say, well, I'm just going to skip this thing because everything's just going along pretty good and it won't matter.
Right.
It does matter.
Does matter. That's what the captain of the Titanic said. Go to sleep. Don't worry about it. Full speed ahead. Oh, well, you see something big up there? Look how big we are.
It looks like a little tip.
Yeah.
It has nothing to
do. Give me a freaking break. These people.
Hey, look, if you don't pay attention.
Now,
you're back.
Before we were discussing a bunch of stuff, and I wanted to bring up this this young man again in Shannon Namodi. Who's been held hostage in jail in Franklin County since August, 27th, 2012. Without anything.
Charges, trial, anything.
Well, one time it was, but that was like a year ago, and those charges have been suddenly evaporated. They just evaporated.
Yeah.
So he's just being held because he needed a place to sleep, I guess. And, you know, he needed a place to sleep.
Well,
don't worry about it. We got a place for you. Come in here.
Yeah.
Of course, you're going to have six guards guard you 24 hours a day, and you'll get 1 hour a day to go out and exercise or go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
I mean, what, are you kidding me?
And no one can see it, not even your mother. Forget it. So there's something very, very, very...
And the thing is that...
If the guy is guilty, man, charge him. Go ahead. Have a trial.
Well, no, we don't do that in Guantanamo. See, this is Guantanamo, I guess it would be north.
Oh.
Northeast, northwest. This is Guantanamo northwest.
I think, unfortunately, I come from Mississippi. Because you do have those little regressive pockets every once in a while. You know, you're going out in the backwoods, you're speeding through some back road, and then suddenly... they're the good old boys just waiting for you. And they're like, welcome to our county. Yeah.
But I saw that sign. There's no county. I drove 15 minutes. It said the end of the line. It was 5 minutes long.
They rule absolutely over here, apparently. But the part that bothers me, again, if you got something to say about this boy, if you got something to charge him with, if you're accusing him of a crime, then go ahead and prosecute.
Well, they don't do that in Guantanamo. It's the same thing. It's the same application. He's being held. He's guarded with four people guarding, standing over him 24 hours a day. He must be worse than Abdul Nadal. He must be worse than everybody in the daggone Al-Qaeda. I mean, how the hell is this boy, who I think he just turned 20 now, why does he need all these guards? Why does he need to be in protective custody? What did he do?
I mean, how did he end up solitary? I mean,
nobody's dead. Nobody's dead. You know? No money has disappeared. I mean, I don't understand this. How is this even remotely possible?
It did disappear for a short time.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And it appeared briefly on YouTube. And then magically reappeared somehow.
Yeah, they tell us about that YouTube picture.
I haven't ever figured it out.
About
they
that.
Recovered the money. Right. Now, turned in.
Well, you saw it. Now, what was
it on the table after they saw
what
it?
Was the picture that you saw on YouTube?
Now,
show
so
it to
the
me.
YouTube is, there is a...
is that picture still on YouTube?
Yeah, it's on the guy's feed.
But is it still there?
I'm just saying, yeah. I think that David Adams had links to it and stuff like that. But anyway, so this boy that is in the neighborhood where our... poor Child Shannon is now involved in this intricate, you know, crime.
Mm-hmm.
The guy who everyone ID'd as the actual suspect and the guy who has been in trouble many times in this neighborhood with all kinds of apparent or rumored to be nefarious activities from, you know, robberies to drugs to everything else.
Yeah.
This punk kind of kid that's there, he shows up on his, you know, this is just a strange coincidence, but he shows up on his
very
page.
It almost like the Twilight Zone.
Standing in his room with tons of money all over his bed and holding his hands, saying, killed somebody or hurt somebody or something, and got it and said, y'all should be charging me with murder tonight on the night that happened.
And see,
they charged this guy. That
the woman lived, so he didn't even know. He thought she was dead.
Mm-hmm. But that was on his Facebook page, and the picture and all is still there. You know, it's on the internet. You can find it. But this kid, who everybody identified as being the perpetrator, is literally holding money that somehow miraculously now has been returned into the office or something. That's what I want to know, when and how it was done. Because at first there was a robbery, and then they said they recovered the money. Recovered from where? That's what I want to know.
Well, when we get David Adams, when he calls in, we'll ask him that.
It wasn't in Shannon's pocket.
Right.
You know. So, I mean, again, we have this whole weird thing where, you know, to refresh people's...
Yeah, that's right. It wasn't in his pocket when he was holding the woman who was bleeding.
Right. Well, again, we have this weird thing where a lady was attacked in her home, supposedly upstairs.
Mm.
I mean, her room apparently had like $50,000, $30,000, something in cash.
Yeah, $64,000.
Yeah, sitting there in an envelope. You know, that's normal. But anyway.
Of course.
So somehow,
there's nothing peculiar about that, is it?
And she said her own daughter did it with another guy, paid somebody to come and get the money and beat her and kill her. And she was knocked partially out, but they thought she was dead. And
yes.
Heard and saw them talking over her and everything else, saying, get the money, get the money. So then she runs from the house, saying they're trying to kill me, they're stealing my money, runs past Shannon in his car, and he jumps out and helps her. He's the one who bandages her up, calls 911, waits for
Well, you know, I think the people who were his friends called 911. He didn't call because he didn't have a phone. Right.
But he was there with her the whole time, waited till the police got there, gave his name, and then waited with her till the ambulance ready to take her off. Then stayed at the scene and helped the police for the entire night. Right? And then that next morning or so, they charge him with the crime. Now, that's the gist of it.
Don't be a bystander. That's what it says.
Here's what I don't understand.
Let the person die if you see him.
He should be in the Olympics if he can go upstairs in someone's home.
Right.
Beat them.
Beat them.
Go run closets or wherever they are.
Right.
You flee the room because he's beat you.
Right.
You race downstairs.
Right.
You run out to the first car you find and go, oh, God, help me.
Yeah.
Please.
Yes.
And it's the same
person. Same person.
Now,
that can only happen in the Twilight Zone.
This guy was obviously jumping banisters, flying past her,
right,
and then jumped into a car somehow. That was, you know, his car or something. Just waiting.
Well, he had a ski mask on. That's why she didn't recognize him.
She ran into his arms. Oh, you know, I mean, it's just amazing. It's ludicrous. That's what it is. But it's not ludicrous that he's in prison for a year plus.
Well, there's Guantanamo Northwest, and I can see that. But we're going to have a little more of that when the mother of Shannon,
Franklin,
the movie calls in, along with David Adams, the person who has been the columnist and the writer and the blogger who sought all this information out. We will have them on. They'll be here at the top of the hour. We'll have them at the top of the hour.
Okay.
But
fantastic.
We have a just so many things I was talking about before you got here.
We've had everything from the Ukrainian
Issa.
Daryl.
Dow Issa.
Yeah.
And we had this.
You say Issa. I say Issa. Issa.
The 50th vote. 50th vote.
What?
To get rid of Obamacare.
Celebration, 50th anniversary.
50th anniversary.
Of the no.
Right. As a matter of fact, the Democrats should have taken their money and had a gold ring every Progressive Party's desk in the House before they got it. That said 5-0. They should have did that. They should have spent the money. It is worth that.
Hey, the Republicans have spent the money. You know how much millions of these 50 votes have cost us now, taxpayers? Because every time they have a vote in Congress,
now,
it costs us.
Every time they have a vote in Congress, that means see, here's the thing. What is it when you constantly do the same thing over and over and expect to change? What is that called?
Insanity.
Insanity, okay.
And we're not talking about an exercise program on TV.
No. Why would you vote to get rid of something when you know you can't get rid of it?
Right. Because that's them. That is what they are. You know, it is insane. They don't care.
It's
not normal. Because normal people would.
All of them? No, I think it's a minute minority. Who has a gun to the head of the person who's in the majority of their party, but he is also the person that gave that minority the gun and the bullets.
So what we have, though, the situation is the American voter.
Yes.
Wandering through the woods.
Wandering through the woods.
There goes a knife.
See, that's wrong right here. Why are you wandering through the woods?
Well,
this is the problem I have.
They were lost that day. And then,
I mean, this is like Wonderland on TV.
There was a nicely dressed rabbit.
Oh, right.
With a watch.
Where
was? Follow them, and guess where they ended up? At a tea party.
At a tea party.
With a guy with this crazy hat. And unfortunately.
Yes.
The man with the hat. Vote again! 50th time! And then everybody takes a sip of tea. And they blow out the candles, but they're the sparkly kind. They come right back.
The sparkly kind.
And
they keep coming back and back.
It's kind of scary. But the sad part about this fantasy is that this is real life.
This is real life.
Really doing it.
So the thing that I want to know is why would someone just – oh, I know. Was that – guy with the hat? Was his name Raphael?
May have been. I have a hard time separating them all.
Raphael,
because, you
Cruz?
Know, what they say, crazy. Looks kind of like crazy. Is kind of like
looks. He talks crazy.
They're all crazy. I can't distinguish the crazy. Though.
And is he a citizen?
Is he Canadian? I can't remember.
Well, he can't be. So why is he down here talking about his Canadian senator's son?
Oh, no. You mean the Cuban. I'm sorry. I always thought you were talking about his Canadian son. But you meant the Cuban.
Yes.
Okay.
The Cuban defector who was on the run because he was a traitor to Batista and Castro.
Went down as a fundamentalist preacher.
Right. But that's what I'm saying. Does that... Well, see, you missed the whole...
Are they imams? What's that name for fundamentalist preacher? I can't remember. Anyway, but you know, all terrorists, they kind of look like... But, so this guy and his son and their Randy colleague.
Oh, yeah.
They like to stir things up and do the same type of stuff over and over and over. Like, say that they're going to abolish every agency and department of government. You know.
Every agency in the Department of Government.
So here's my problem, again.
Yes.
If you forget something, you hate something, if you think it's wrong and destructive, you think there should be no IRS, there should be no federal government with this oversight and laws and all that hoopla in Washington, that evil place, why do you go and become it? Why does that become your career? Because they're up there getting the paycheck, sitting in the chair. With all their complaining, they're the government.
Well, here's the thing. That I before you got here, I was talking about the head of the Oversight Committee for the country, Mr. Daryl Issa, who is actually a thug. He was, well, I don't want to go into everything that he's done, but he was arrested at least four times for car theft. He loves cars. He just steals them and denies. He's, you know, it's like that scene from Die for a Married Man, where the guy says goodbye to his wife. She goes off. 5 minutes later, knock at the door. Gorgeous girl comes in there with a long fur coat. She takes it off. She's got practically nothing on. They go in the bedroom, get into bed. 5 minutes later, the wife comes back, comes into the room, and she's shocked. And she says, she doesn't know what to say. They look at her. They don't say anything. They both get out of the bed. The husband makes the bed. The girl gets dressed. The girl puts it, well, she didn't have to get dressed. She had nothing on. And she puts on a fur coat, leaves. The husband goes and sits in the chair in the living room reading the paper or smoking a pipe. The wife is still standing in the doorway with her mouth wide open. And all she could say is, would you like some tea, darling? He said, that'd be great. So the whole thing is here, in a nutshell, the guy was saying, all you have to do is deny. Deny.
Well,
and if you say it long enough, no one will believe that it ever happened.
Yeah, we didn't do that.
We didn't do that.
Well,
who do you believe me?
What I love,
me or your lying eyes?
It's like now they say it's Obama's financial disaster. It's Obama's recession. And do we not remember the little shrub that was in office when the entire economy collapsed? I'm pretty sure.
It was down to 6,000 on the Dow Jones. It is now over 16,000. Now, how do we say this man did not do anything? I mean, how are we saying that he's a, oh, no, we haven't done that yet. No, we need to do the show on communist socialism. We keep talking about that because these nut jobs don't understand.
The one they load, he said something about this today, which rather cracked me up. About the 50th vote, he said, you know what they say, 50th time's a charm. Maybe when you hit your 50th repeal vote, you'll win a prize. Maybe the prize is if you get 50 repeal votes, you get one free.
Oh, so that means they're going to get a 51.
Hey,
they're going to have a 51st vote, and this one is on the house. This one is on the house.
Is it legal to try to repeal something more times than there are states?
Wait a minute. Didn't even think about that. Are you trying to say
maybe
that we're approaching that now?
One repeal vote per state, but, you know, can you exceed that? I don't know. I'm just, what is this magic 50 thing? I don't get it, and it's embarrassing. I hope they stop.
But who is it embarrassing for? I mean, now
it's embarrassing for America.
That's correct.
These fools are in there doing this. Look, we've got real issues in the world. You know, there was an interesting stat Bill Moyers brought out the other night on his show, talking about poverty in America. Okay, the richest nation on earth. Which nation is that? Richest nation on earth? America. America now has more children going hungry, more children in poverty than any developed nation on earth. We have more children going hungry than any developed nation on the planet, except for one beat us last year by a few thousand poor starving children.
Russia?
No. Russia actually beat us.
Mississippi. Mississippi.
Romania actually squeaks by.
Romania. They're still in existence?
Romania.
Nobody gobbled them up
they
yet?
They haven't starved all the children yet, so there's still some Romanians left. But that is pathetic to think that we are second to last in the world to starving children.
And proud of it.
Yeah. And no, these guys are voting. The reason that Moyers was talking about this is they just voted again to, you know, end any of these, any kind of food subsidies for children. You know, these are the same Republicans that just voted to end any kind of benefits for vets. You know, these are the same Republicans.
Yes, but wait a minute. How are they ending stuff for vets when they keep saying Ted Cruz said that we need to protect our vets.
Right.
Do not cut. We need he said that we need to cut every single penny in every other project for our veterans. Mm-hmm. So, when we have close to 15% of the people in the military today are on food stamps, 15%. You know, I don't understand why it's not said loud enough. Well, why isn't that repeated from the highest heavens that we have 15% of the people who are fighting in Afghanistan, their wives are at home with the kids and being dispossessed? What, are you kidding me?
Yeah. So why don't we take the millions that we just wasted on 50 ridiculous votes and give it to them?
Oh.
Give it to some of the vets or some of the children of the vets.
Next week we're going to do and you got time, we got to sit down. I've sort of read, but you got to watch Why We Did It.
Oh.
With Rachel Maddow.
Documentary, yep.
Telling you. And these people who come on, who they interviewed, are just proud of it.
About the Iraq War.
They're just proud of it.
Mm-hmm. No, and if you want a reason why our economy stinks, why it crashed, and why we're having a slow recovery, and why there's such high unemployment in America and all these other problems that exist, look directly at endless wars that the Cheney Bush crowd started. That's why. But
well,
why did they do it?
But you see, they did that, then they did the Medicare Part D on top of that, and never offered one single penny to offset that.
You remember, they never even...
They never offset anything.
They never even admitted one penny of the war ever in the entire time they were in office in the budgets, because it would have blown the budget out. It would have been obvious that they were sinking. And they didn't. They blocked it. You remember, they had those just emergency spending authorizations and all that stuff. It's a crime. But, again, let's vote to repeal Obamacare.
Well, all I have to say is that so that's going to be on the agenda for next week. We're going to be talking about that. And we're going to be talking about this. Some elected officials that are running are going to be on the show. I'm going to see most of them this Sunday when I scurry up to Greensboro.
Okay.
And
snag some interviews.
Oh, yeah, I will. And we're going to have Michael Evans calling in next week also. And right now, we have with us the people who we were talking about. Mr. David Adams, who has been writing the blogs and everything for what's been going on in this with this young man, Shannon Nemoti. And we have Elizabeth Kupchik, I hope I pronounced that right, Elizabeth, on the show. And Did I pronounce that correct, Elizabeth?
Hey.
Something?
Kudos.
Yeah. Okay. And David, did you hear any about what we were talking about, Thomas was talking about the, can you just do a short run-over on the young man, Shannon Nemote, and how this whole thing came crashing down?
Yeah, first of all, thank you, Mike. Always a pleasure to be on your show. Thomas, how are you this evening? I did hear it, and he picked up on something that I had been looking for. He stated that there was something that the kid put on his Facebook page about they should be trying to arrest me tonight or something to that effect. I've been looking for that. So after the show, if you can kind of manigle this, Mike, to get that information to me, because I want to see that.
Yeah.
Okay?
Because
Shannon's mother brought that up.
Oh, yeah. I saw it myself.
Okay, and this was the night. Now, am I correct when I heard Thomas say that this was the night that of the actual shooting, or the morning of the actual shooting, the same day of the shooting?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Absolutely.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Well, Mike, to catch your audience up to speed, we're talking about a human rights case where a young man by the name of Shannon Nemote is being held in a Franklin County, North Carolina jail. He's been there going over 18 months now for a crime where there's a volume of evidence that points to the young man's innocence. This happened back on August 16th of 2012. He was at a friend's house in Youngsville, North Carolina, and he was awakened to the sounds of a woman crying in despair, and he went to her aid. She was shot in the head. Shot in the face, actually. She told him that her daughter was involved. Shannon stayed there and assisted her through the entire ordeal until the cops and the EMS arrived. But somehow, strangely, then later on that day, around about 3:10 p.m., Shannon was taken into custody and charged with the crime, despite the fact that, you know, there were reports that initially said that Shannon wasn't the person who did this to her. So that's where we are now. His case has been taken off of the North Carolina management docket system back on February 20th of 2013. He has not been in front of a judge in over a year. Okay? And right now we believe that he's being held unlawfully against his will for charges that are not even in the North Carolina database for him.
Elizabeth, what can you add to that for us to round out this picture?
I just want to add again that they, you know, everything David has said, and on top of that, you know, he's now being held incommunicado. Shannon has no way to communicate with the outside world. I send him letters. In fact, I'm just coming from the post office, mailing him out a letter. I send letters to him. I'm not even sure if he gets them or not anymore. He's held incommunicado. He cannot speak with his family, have any visitations, nothing. We have not laid eyes on Shannon again. The last time I saw Shannon was January the 24th, and we're now in March.
And what is the reason why? What have they said about you visiting?
This is what they have said. The jailhouse has one visitation day for each cell block, like a different day for each cell block. For the people in solitary, it's Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. What is supposed to happen is that the person in jail is presented with a visitation form, and they write down the person's name they want to see. Shannon, I do not believe Shannon is being presented with that visitation form because they did not say that he did not want to see you. What they say is he did not write your name down on the paper. Remember, Shannon is in a cell by himself. The jail can choose whether to present him with that piece of paper or not.
Right.
So at this point, they're saying, because my name is not written on that paper, I cannot see my son.
Okay, well, what do we assume, and I hate to assume, what do we assume the reasons why they want to do this?
They want to break him down. We don't need to assume. The last
piece of haphazardly written paperwork that came out of Klinkerson's office. If everyone gets a chance to go onto the peoplechampion.me blog, they will see that that last piece of paperwork shows that the attorney of record, which is Klinkerson, and the prosecution are trying to squeeze a confession, trying to squeeze a plea deal out of Shannon. They're trying to break him down. They have even said they foresee that this will not go to trial because they're going to get their results before trial. They're really working on his spirit, on his morale, on his fortitude right now. They're beating him down mentally. I do not know what they've done to him physically, but I know mentally they're really working on him.
Okay, what do you think the reason is that they are doing this to Shannon? Why him?
If I could answer that, you know, I could figure out, you know, peace in the Middle East, you know. Why him? Why Shannon?
Well, let me offer this, Michael. Let me offer this, Michael. I believe that there was an extreme rush to judgment, probably from a conspiracy that was spearheaded by the sheriff's office. Now, the young man that we were talking about, this Donald Chalk character that Thomas alluded to prior to us coming on at the top of the hour, this guy is the guy who's actually the person who committed the crime, and he's supposed to be related to the sheriff.
David, what's his name again?
His name's Donald Chalk.
Okay, Donald
Chalk. He's the guy that supposedly actually have committed the crime. Okay, and he's also supposed to be related to the sheriff. Now, I believe that the sheriff, Sheriff Jerry Jones, manipulated the prosecution into indicting this kid. Okay, and now that the state's attorney's office has realized that there's no culpable evidence, everything that they have is in fact exculpatory in this young man's case. Okay, they're trying to cover their behinds now because there's going to be a tremendous lawsuit after this is over. Okay, he was unjustly charged, wrongly accused, when there's a volume of evidence that points to his innocence, and they've continuously perpetuated this entire matter by keeping him incarcerated, keeping him from his family, and placing him in segregation to wear down his mental condition to get him to plead to some lesser charge or to plea to something that he didn't do. So this is the reason why they're doing this to Shannon Imhotep.
Okay, so the thing is that, remember seeing all these stories where, the sheriff, in the old Wild West, the sheriff was the law, and they could throw people in jail and forget people didn't even know there was a Constitution. And I guess most people he can't be the first one they've done this to. He can't be the only one they've done this to. But in this particular case, in Shannon Namodi's case, they didn't think he would have advocates.
Right.
And I think because of where he was at, he was sleeping in his car, they just didn't dream that he would have an advocate that would do any of this. Because this can't be a first time.
I think that was a courthouse that burnt 160 years worth of records.
Right, right. You're right about that.
So we will never know how many more times they have done this.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. I think what it was that Thomas looked up before is, and since 1862, they've had the most cases against the 6th and 14th Amendment or violates. Violations of the 6th and 14th Amendment. Now, the thing is, we're talking about this. Don't they have a newspaper? Who's the head of the newspaper in Franklin County? What newspaper, if they have any? Do they have one in Franklin County?
They have the Franklin Dispatch, and that editor had refused, had written very many letters to the editor when this first happened. Because that editor continued to print lies and lies and lies about the situation. But she refused. And I think her first name is Carrie, like C-A-R-E-Y. I can't remember her last name. They refused to publish my letters. In fact, they even denied. They said a woman calling herself Shannon's mother. I am Shannon's mother. I don't need to call myself anything. That's who I am, you know. They refused to print anything about Shannon.
What's this woman's name?
A positive light.
What's this woman's name?
Her first name is Carrie. I cannot remember her last name.
And what is her newspaper?
The Franklin Dispatch.
Franklin Dispatch.
Let me go ahead and tell you when
this story got broken on the Franklin County News Online, which is an online-only newspaper, like a blog newspaper. When the Franklin County News Online started carrying Shannon's story and they saw how much local interest there was, this woman now emails me and says, oh, we'd like to do an interview with you. I just sent an email and said, madam, when I was trying to get attention, when you were busy printing the sheriff's lies, you refused to hear my opinion, you refused to get Shannon's story, you refused to do anything. But now that he sees that if you're going to sell my newspapers, you want Shannon's story. Take your rag of lies and keep it.
Okay, so you're saying
I don't want to have anything to do with them.
So you're saying the Franklin Dispatch is a blog newspaper or
no,
a printed
newspaper? The Franklin Dispatch is a printed newspaper.
Okay. And what's the other one?
Franklin County News Online.
Okay, Franklin County News Online. Okay. I'm writing this down because I'm going to give these people a call. Franklin County News Online. Okay. The only time I was in Franklin County and I organized the African American Caucus there, it seemed to me it was like something out of Mississippi Burning. I mean, as Thomas said, the woods when you leave Charlotte. I mean, it's like, don't break down.
Yep.
Just keep on driving.
Mississippi Burning. Mississippi
yes.
Burning is a very good analogy, okay, of the situation down there. Okay.
Yeah.
If you go back as far as looking at the primary officer's police reports from that night, you'll find that Lieutenant Mitchell, Lieutenant Little of the Youngfield Police Department, he honed right in on Shannon. Okay? Shannon was the only person that seemed suspicious to him, and probably because he was the only black person at the crime scene. Okay? He asked Shannon where he was. Shannon told him he was sleeping in the truck. He probably didn't believe that and didn't understand fully the relationship that Shannon had with the family whose yard he was staying in. Okay?
Right.
And when he went into the home, he asked the grandmother, the oldest woman in the Young's family home, who is that guy, and does he live here? Okay, and she said, he stays in the truck. They let him sleep out there sometimes. Okay, nowhere else in this guy's report did this police officer indicate that he questioned anyone else and challenged whether or not a person belonged there, because they were all white. So they must have had to have been, they must have had to have been in the right place, because they were all white, you know? And then to further illustrate, you know, this Mississippi Burning connection in this particular case. Now, I recently discovered a document. Once these 150 pages mysteriously showed back up in the county clerk's office down there, Beth Crudup forwarded a document to me, which just happens to be the Facebook search warrant application. Okay? Now, from the articles, if you remember, on the 17th, this CI, or this confidential informant, told Lieutenant Little he knew of a person, okay, who heard Shannon and this girl conspiring to kill her mother, all right? That's the whole premise for his involvement. The theory has always been that Shannon conspired with the victim's daughter to kill her and steal $64,000 from her home. Now, when he got that search warrant and executed the search warrant, his findings revealed that there were no records. Shannon had no communication with that girl or this boy DJ Chunk, okay? In my opinion, based on my expert experience, that should have changed the course of the entire investigation. Number one, why did Donald Chalk lie to the cops, okay, about Shannon allegedly having a text exchange with him about borrowing a shotgun, okay? They never went back to ask about that. They never addressed the fact that, you know, he never communicated with this girl. So if you don't have a theory, you don't have a plot, you know, what justifies the charges? It doesn't make sense to me. So this just shows you the blatant prejudice in his case against this young man, okay? And then the tip of the ice, the tip of the iceberg with that report is that he didn't file it. He didn't file it until 90 days later, over 90 days later, which means that when Shannon's case went before the grand jury or the judicial court who decided to indict him, that document was never considered. So they suppress exculpatory evidence in this young man's case. So that's why I say that, the term Mississippi burning, that's adequate. That's appropriate for this case.
The sad part about this is to defend Mississippi because, this is a rare thing for me.
We have a defender.
I never defend Mississippi. But at least the Mississippi burning cliches are from the past. The sad part about this is right now, today, Franklin County.
Yeah.
So we may have to come up with a new standard, Franklin County burning or something.
Yeah.
This place is unbelievable.
Yeah, Mississippi's already burned down already. It's been burning for years.
They've made some progress down there. But this thing is unbelievable. I can't believe that this is happening now. And on top of that, the completely separate crime of who burned or ordered burned 160 year worth of records that were found.
Yeah.
You know,
That's at the clerk's office. What? Yeah. How did that happen?
The historical archivists sitting there reading the article right now. They're in there investigating it, going through it because they turned it over to historians for the historical value. And then as soon as they find out in Franklin County and the court, they come in with the cops, seize all the records, and burn them in the incinerator and building one by one. They burned the entire lot.
I wonder why.
Yeah, exactly. So that right there is a crime, isn't it?
Who they protected?
They burned the
Well,
that's what I keep going. I don't know, just before I came on the radio show, I received a call from an intern at WTVD News Channel 11. And I'm hoping that they see, they had the wherewithal to print the, or to air the sheriff's lies over and over and over and over again. I think they aired it for like 3 or 4 weeks straight back when this first broke out in 2012. All they would air was what the sheriff was saying. They didn't care what I was saying and any of Shannon's friends were saying or what the victim's family was saying. All they had was this, crazy, convoluted story that the sheriff kept airing. And I hope that they have the guts to come back and tell the truth about the situation. Because it makes no sense that the mainstream media, Channel 5, Channel 11, etc., were willing and ready to air the sensationalistic, complete, fabricated story that Sheriff Jerry Jones was touting. But when it comes to telling the truth about the horror of what Shannon's situation really is, you don't hear from anyone. I'm glad Channel 11 is considering, the intern gave me a call, and I asked her, what happens next? She said, I'll just pass this along to a senior producer or something like that. But it is amazing with what sluggishness the press will move when it's the truth. They want sensational lies, but the horrible, scared, and the, blatant, ugly truth, they're like, we have to think about that. So easy for them to come out with the lies week after week, but not be there to tell the truth.
Well, the thing is, why are we, why is it, why did they think, and we've said this already, is this in the best interest of the entire Franklin County Association to keep this like it is? Everybody in all of Franklin County?
No, I don't think that's the case at all, Mike. I really don't. I really don't think that's the case at all. Just from the communications that I've been getting through email and inboxes on Facebook from people who've given information pertaining to this case, they're just completely terrorized by the sheriff, okay? These people are terrorized. There was one caller who, one person who contacted me who wanted to meet me and Beth in person, but said that she wouldn't do it in Franklin County, anywhere but Franklin County, okay? She didn't want to talk on the phone. It had to be in person. So these people are actually terrified, okay, of the way the sheriff is running the town down there. Okay, so I don't think it's the totality of all the citizens of Franklin County. I think there are decent law-abiding citizens down there who care, who want to get involved, but afraid of reprisals and repercussions from the sheriff's department.
Right.
Which is unfortunate. Remember, this is a sheriff that they had voted out of office. They had voted. They had thought that they had gotten rid of this guy, but this guy got himself appointed onto the seat. That is how much control he wields over that county, you know?
Tell us that story, because that's an amazing story.
He wasn't reelected. The last election, he wasn't reelected. And they had a sheriff that came in there, Sheriff Green. Somehow some money came up missing. That guy couldn't prove that he didn't do it. I think that Jerry Jones set him up. But the guy couldn't prove that he didn't steal the money. So he was forced to resign, and he was subsequently charged and convicted. The county commissioners turn around and reappoint Jerry Jones as the new sheriff. And then they were supposed to have a special election back in December to appoint a permanent sheriff. And then they postponed that, and that particular reelection has never materialized. Now it's time for a whole new election altogether.
Well,
and that's funny how everything.
I've seen those movies before.
Everything in this county just doesn't happen. It's just like charging this poor child with a crime. It just doesn't happen. It just vanishes somehow. So they didn't even elect a sheriff. I bet that's a violation of
you think?
You know, Constitution or something.
Yeah.
Definitely a violation of state constitution.
Absolutely.
This is just neat when you start digging into this county. Woo.
Oh, please. Well, we have a couple callers on here that I don't know if they're just listeners for calls, but we'll find out. Hello there. Who's this? Hello? Hello, who's this? 8286, who's this? Last four. I guess you're just a listener then. That's good. Okay. Let's go to the next one. Hello, who's this? Can you hear me?
I was just listening in, and like I say, you know, I'm very well aware of the Shannon Imodis case. Like I said, just about every time he had to was supposed to appear in court, I would be there. And they wouldn't even bring this young man in on the transportation from jail to court because they automatically knew that they would not let him appear before the judge. So basically I'm just here bearing witness to pretty much what's said, and everything is correct, even right down to the burning of the historical records. Now, my personal opinion is, like you said, these records was burned to cover up the actions that's taking place against the African Americans within Franklin County. Now, I had I heard from a very reliable source that there was a heinous crime committed there in Franklin County concerning a African-American woman that was in jail, I'm going to say it's probably back in the 60s. This jailer, a white jailer, was repeatedly raping this woman, and evidently one day they must have been around a tool shed or something, and she grabbed a pick and stabbed him and killed him. And, of course, you know, the woman was killed, you know. There are some horrible things going around there. And like I said, they are very glad of their history that they have there. concerning I'm gonna put it like this: the rebel flag, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And they're real proud of that.
I guess you have lived in that vicinity and know that the history of Franklin County. As I said, I've only been there once in my life, and you know, I don't care what people say about me. You know, I just go around, do what I got to do, and I leave. I eat. I don't care. But the thing is that, you know, because I know I wasn't staying there. So, but the thing is that, and this is what I was told. I guess David can relate that story about the chair of the NAACP in Franklin County. David, can tell us that?
No. Yeah, I would like to speak on that. I was there in the county. By the way, young people activist Thomas Ellis, and like I said, I was in that county at the time when the NAACP was approached, and this NAACP chair was like, "No way, I'm getting involved in any black kid that's locked up in jail. I gotta live in this city." That was his statement. You know, because
go ahead. That's exactly what he said.
Yeah.
No, but that is frightening. And now the NAACP chair for the state, has, I understand, he has said almost the same thing. Is that correct?
He pretty much did. He pretty much did. And like I say, don't get me wrong. I appreciate the NAACP, but right now it's all about prestige with these guys, and it's really pretty much surrounded around legislation with the little march and the gathering of the monies and things. They're not concerned right now about anybody that's been wronged or anything like that, at least not this NAACP locally, nor the state that the chair of the NAACP. I've even spoke to these guys personally.
Well, you know, I understand. How do we face people in? We're already talking about this part of the country, but I'm sure it goes on all over. But this is just in your face. This is just in your face. And how do people who have been bit by dogs, sprayed with fire hoses, not explain that to the kids who are growing up? And the kids who are growing up have no idea what took place 40 years ago, 50 years ago. I mean, how is that even reality?
Well, you see, basically, like I said, I will put that on people pretty much fooling themselves, because, I mean, they're walking around saying racism don't exist. Racism is just as strong today as it has been back in the 60s. But something, you know, it's covered up in a new way. It's not covered up necessarily by the sheets and the hoods. It's right now it's a war. It's a war, and it's pretty much done with a pencil and a pen, computer, so to speak. And like I said, you know, and everybody walk around in the sunshine whistling, saying racism gone, but evidently this is proof that it's not.
Also, to add to that, Michael, you and I discussed this, I think, maybe a week or so ago, down there in southern states and rural areas like that. A lot of the blacks that live down there, they live on properties that were inherited, either through their family acquiring it through former slave owners or you know, the children, you know, received it from their parents after they died or what have you. But they're very complacent. They're comfortable. You know, the cost of living is not that, you know, expensive. And, I mean, they don't want to get involved in politics down there. They're not concerned about the things that are going on in their communities that impacts, you know, their entire ethnic community in general. Because, I mean, I'm okay. And that seems to be the theme for African-Americans in general. You know, I'm okay. I mean, I'm not. That's their problem. You know, I don't. Why would I want to get involved with that? That doesn't concern me. I'm fine here. My status, my situation is okay. So that's the mindset. That's where that strong apathy that comes from down there, and then plus also a lack of education. So it's a,
right.
it's a number of dynamics that causes, you know, us not to be proactive about these kinds of things. You could never pull something like this off in Philadelphia, okay? You could never pull nothing like this. You probably couldn't even pull this off in Birmingham right now, okay?
See, I beg to differ when it comes to a lack of education. Like I said, I mean, I'm not going to consider that as an insult or nothing because I'm from down this way myself. But like I said, you know, it's just, I would say, more like people are content, comfortable, you see. And you are only a victim when you become a victim, so to speak. Now, you are right in so many ways. I mean, they are comfortable here in the ways to the point where they don't even go to the election polls. Like many states and cities do.
Well, you know, right now we have a young lady joining us, and I'd like to ask her what she thinks about this conversation because she's been here on the show. Her name is Kim Grimes. Kim?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Hello, everyone.
What is your thoughts on, I know you've been listening, what is your thoughts on this situation that we find, that this young man finds himself in?
A lot of the guests that were speaking were speaking accurately when we talk about where we are today. And how much has changed or have not changed. And my thoughts and my views are that it's our responsibility individually to take a stand and stand for what is right. And that unfortunately we don't see that enough to make a difference. And I think that we have to go back to grassroots to begin to and it starts with building the relationship with one another and really getting them to understand where we are and getting them on board so we all can stand. And when we stand together, it's a consolidated front as well as we have a strong voice. And so that's how I see it. It takes, you know how the cliche is, it takes a village.
Yep.
And that's how I'm thinking as well. It takes us coming together, standing together, and making a difference.
Well, and the reason why I asked you, because, I mean, this is what you do. This
yes.
is what you do. Motivating people to get together to understand what a difference they can make. So how would you get people to understand that they're just letting all this happen without any reprisals, not even trying to defend themselves? Why do people do this?
I think a part of it, Mike, is that they don't know. And it's not a part of, you know, being comfortable, because I know someone said that as well, but there are
yes.
some that don't know, and then, you know, we want to say it's ignorance, but it doesn't show up like that. They just don't know because they are not being informed. So, for example, this weekend I'm going with a group of teens, and we're going door to door. That doesn't happen anymore. We're going door to door, and it's not for an election. It's for us to reach out to the teens and the youth in the community to find out, you know, what's going on with them. And it just took a small group of us to come together and to put that together. And so I'm saying that to say that when we keep them informed, when we look back in the 60s, which was I was just a baby then, but it was the information flowed and everyone was informed. And so even though we have the advanced technology, we have Facebook and Twitter, and it's there are still those who are not on the internet. They still do not know. And so one of the things that I believe and I like to say is that let me tell you, so then you cannot say you did not know. So it's my place to make you aware. I just want to make you aware of this. And so if they choose at that point to say that they did not know, we all know that that is not the truth. So we have to come up with means to keep us aware and to shine the light on and allow our voice to be heard so it something can be done.
Well, but how you say you talk to people and so they can't say that they did not know. We have an NAACP chairman in Franklin County that knows and says no.
I get what you're saying. So, but it's not up to the NAACP. It's up to that next door neighbor. It's up to their neighbor and the next neighbor, and to come together. That's the hard part right there. So when a movement, when we look at the news right now, we see a lot of things going on in Russia, but you see it because of the mass numbers. They're making a difference, and that's what I'm saying. It's not heard when we have a few, but when we begin to get the numbers together, get the people together, and it really, really requires on the ground, ringing the, you know, knocking on the door, and making them aware of everything that we moved away from that.
And that's
my stand.
That's what I've been asking for, you know, is really like, you know, a prayer vigil or something where the community gets to come together in Franklin County. You know, we were trying to see if we can get March the 17th, which is a Monday, you know, if we could do something where we will pull together, where the community will get a chance to come together and say that they know and they disapprove of what is happening with Shannon Nyamudi. You know, let the local community come together.
Right. Well, we have somebody else. Hello, who's this on the line? 8286, last four. If you're just listening, that's fine. Okay. What do we do now, David? What do we do now?
Well, right now, as far as the immediate, as far as Shannon's judicial process, his mother's already taken the proactive measures to file a habeas before the North Carolina appellate courts. Okay, that's a 3-judge panel who hear it. Hopefully, you know, she'll get some justice in that regard. Because you keep in mind, although Shannon has recently had his lawyer, his lawyer recently filed a continuance in the case. Shannon has still been in prison, been locked up for over a year. So therefore, it still triggers the presumption that his 6th and 14th Amendment constitutional rights have been violated. Okay, so I'm hoping that these judges will rule in that regard. In the meantime, we're working on addressing these attorneys, the attorneys from Cheshire, Parker, Schneider, and Bryan. Okay, who hasn't done anything for this young man after being paid a $50,000 retainer for his legal fees. Okay, all the things that we've done, his mother's tried to do to free this young man, should have been done by his attorney. Additionally, his housing classification at the Franklin County Detention Center needs to be addressed. Why is this young man being held in segregation, in solitary confinement, and being denied access to his family, not being able to call his mother, not being able to call his relatives? These are things that his attorney legally, and it's not outside of the scope of their responsibility. You know, they've been hired to represent this young man, and it's time for them to step up. We need to put their feet to the coal to get them to do their jobs.
Well, Joe Chesler is a major lawyer in Wake County, and this lapse on his part, because it is his part, because this man works for him, is an utter disgrace. And what do we do? Go ahead.
That's what I kept saying. saying. I kept saying, Joe Tesha, I have talked to Joe Tesha himself back in 2012. You know, you don't have to let a car fall over the cliff to say that this car is about to fall over a cliff. If the cliff is in front of you, you raise the alarm. And I talked with Joe Tesha personally, and his only question to me was, do you trust us? And my answer is no. Didn't trust you then, don't trust you now. I don't know you. I don't know what you do. But this particular attorney that you put on my son and this law firm's conduct in regards to Shannon Yamodi has been disgraceful.
Okay, then let me ask you a question. Olivia. Was there at any time a officer of the court appointed instead of one of these high-priced lawyers?
There were at least three that I know of. I think there were six total, but I think there were at least three that I know of because they would get appointed and get taken off, get appointed and get taken off, get appointed and get taken off. You know?
Why? There's something wrong with this picture.
Taken off because they were trying to do their job?
We talked about this racial injustice I did at the beginning of the show with the young man, he's 47 years old, who has one of the best records in all of the court system with civil rights. He's been in front of the Supreme Court twice, and this man was denied being the head of the Equal Rights Division of the government because he he wrote a brief that asked for this man to be released from murder. And he won the case. The man was released from murder, of course, but he's serving life because he was going to get the electric chair or whatever they do here in North Carolina, hang here or whatever, probably. But anyway, the thing is, how do you get punished for doing your job? How does a young man get punished for saving somebody? Is it just because you're black?
County, that's what it looks like.
Well, let's answer this way, Mike. Let Beth Crudup tell you what she found out. You remember, Mike, in the beginning when we first started talking about this case, and I pointed out that order that was allegedly issued by Judge Height to have Shannon's case taken off of the docket system until such time that the district attorney decided to put it back on. You remember that document, and I told you, you know, that I was suspicious of it because it appeared to be a pre-printed form that was just handwritten. Okay, mm-hmm. let Beth Crudup tell you what the clerk told her.
Okay,
when I
Beth?
questioned the clerk of court regarding that particular document, I said, look, is this a pre-printed thing or something you guys just use every once in a while? She said, these are blank forms. These are pre-printed blank forms that the judge uses when they do not have enough evidence or enough information to bring a case to trial. They use this to hold the prisoners, to hold the people in jail. Instead of releasing them, saying there's not enough evidence to prosecute you here, they hide people using these forms. Because if there is reason to declare a case exceptional, there is a different form and it's much longer. If there's an actual reason for a case to be exceptional, to go and they do it according to what the law says, where the state, you know, give statement of why it is exceptional and give a time frame, et cetera, et cetera. But these forms that they just fill out, they keep there when the judge wants to make somebody pay. But they just don't have enough evidence to do that, so they go and squirrel them away, and I guess that's when they start with their you're going to take a plea situation, you know. They go and hide people using these forms, because this form actually takes you out of the computer system until such a time they feel, oh, we're going to get a plea out of you, or, you know, we have managed to concoct enough lies to stand in a kangaroo court.
Now, Mike, you remember me telling you that I thought that phone was pre-printed and there was something funky with that?
Right. It is.
This was confirmed by the clerk of courts. And you remember Beth went down and spoke with the clerk of courts for Franklin County, and she spoke with her assistant. And the other document that we made in comparison to that one was this the search warrant affidavit to obtain Shannon's DNA for comparison purposes that was submitted before the courts by Captain Mitchell of the Franklin County Sheriff's Department. Now, she questioned them about that handwritten addendum on there. Now, they admitted that the initials is allegedly supposed to be Judge Donald Stevens's initials, but they say that they don't know who wrote the handwritten addendum on there. Okay? Because this is the stuff that we were supposed to discuss last week.
Yep, the clerk of court's office has denied writing anything on that document, that number 8 addendum. All of the assistant clerks of court have said, no, we did not write that. And Judge Stevens himself has denied writing that because I presented that document to his office in Raleigh, and he took a look at it. They showed it to him, and he said that's his initial, but he cannot tell you who wrote that document in.
So, and David, Elizabeth, you have all this already copied, right? That form and everything else, correct?
I have a letter from Judge Stevens, actually. I have a physical letter from Judge Stevens that says that he put his initials there. His initials and his signature are his, but he has nothing to say about that number 8 writing, that number 8 addendum over there. He says, and the clerk of court's office said, we didn't write it. None of our people wrote that in. We don't know where that came from.
You have a pattern here that Mike alluded to earlier. He said it seems as if, you know, you can't have the case appear out of nowhere and that this is the first time they've ever done this. So now you've got a situation where they even admit they use a holder form anytime they have somebody that they want to pin something on but they don't have evidence for. They can just disappear them in a back room until they either go find or manufacture evidence or they elicit a confession from the person.
Was this in the heat of the night?
They've got a pre-made form for it already. You don't have that unless you've done it dozens of times.
Well, you know what the sheriff said there.
A unique case. You wouldn't have the pre-printed form ready.
Well, you know, it's just like what the sheriff said in Heat of the Night. I got the wallet that was missing and the body that was dead. But we don't have any of that here.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just completely... You know, you would not. This could not pass as a story because no one would believe it. This could not be a story. No one would. This ass below. That's not even in the realm of possibility. And who was the one? Was it you, Elizabeth, or Thomas, that was told by the state attorney general's office that they didn't believe that this could happen here?
That was me. That was me. That's what I was told by the department of the State Attorney General's office that handles, I guess they called it corrections or whatever. You know,
Public Safety Division. The Public
Safety
Division.
I called there, but I did not get a call back yet. And I'm going to call there again on Monday. I had called there and to speak to, what's that guy's name? I have it written down here. What's the guy?
Public
Safety. Yeah, Tom Jones.
No.
Tom Jones is his name.
Oh, Tom Jones, right. It's not unusual, but it's Tom Jones. I'm going to give him another call because Tom Jones needs to explain to me why someone could be held. We now, it's going almost 2 years, but at least a year without even going to trial at all. He needs to explain that. And if he doesn't want to explain it to me, then we need to go to the Attorney General himself. And this, I believe, is the year when this Attorney General, Mr. Roy Cooper, is running for office.
Yeah, Mike. But if I can, before the end of your show, if I could just frame this for you. The Attorney General's office is a good place to start. I don't know how much leeway you're going to get. I know you have a lot of contacts and affiliates that could probably get you a one-on-one with him. I know he's going to be on your show.
Roy Cooper's going to be on your show, you know, for the upcoming elections and everything. But, you know, we have to really just consider what this case is telling us, okay? You have police reports that say that the woman didn't even know who attacked her, okay? You had eyewitnesses on the scene who told the cops that they saw a white guy running from the scene. You got a white guy who people in the community are saying did the crime. He's posting on Facebook all the money, you know, that he got from it. And the same day, according to your producer, Thomas, he stated that they should be locking me up tonight, okay?
Right.
And then, you know, you have all this funny paperwork, you know, and then they concoct the story that Shannon conspired with this lady's daughter, okay, to kill her and steal this volume of money. And I heard Thomas talking about the money earlier, and he was wondering how they found it. Now, they found the money in an abandoned building not too far away from where this took place, but they never explained what source or what led them to that money. Okay, and then you got this guy J.E. Heinrich of the State Bureau of Investigations, who conducted a Facebook search of Shannon and the young girl's Facebook account and found that there was no communication against this kid and this girl or the alleged witness who said that he heard the conversation between them. All right, and then you look at the forensics. All right, there's no DNA match. Where's the DNA? All the discovery for DNA, for fingerprints, okay, for any other culpable forensics that they possibly have found. It's not in the file. It's not in the file, okay? And then you got that Facebook result that was turned in 30 days, 90 days later. They held it from the district courts. It wasn't filed in the district courts, okay? All of these things, man, I mean, it points to malicious prosecution and this mysterious volume of paperwork. 150 pages of paperwork were never put back in there until I called for the prosecution of Jerry Jones and Annette Sellers. Okay, I mean, this is a very malicious prosecution of a young man who was willing to defend his country in defense of democracy. This is an American tragedy, you know, and I just don't understand why no politician down there in the state of North Carolina, whether in Franklin County or otherwise, has the fortitude to stand up and say that this is wrong.
I think it's very.
Let me also just say, I hope that y'all are copying every available scrap of paper, memo, things you find on the floor, receipts from the McDonald's, anything possible in that county, and removing it from that county, because just like the other treasure trove, everything to do with this case could be burned tomorrow. The way 150 pages are appearing and disappearing out of a file, you know, that's the hallmark of corruption.
And the Titus whole thing up here, or what is on the schedule to happen next week, Elizabeth?
Next week, you know, I'm still holding out to hear from Harvard. I hope to hear from the Court of Appeals. I'm not expecting to hear from the Court of Appeals next week, but we're trying to organize. I'm trying to locate a church in Franklin County to have a one-time Monday night vigil on March the 17th, which is like week after next. I want to get the word out about that event, and I'm going to put it on the website.
I want to be
in Franklin County, but I have to finish talking. I have asked a couple of pastors. I don't have a location, you know, solidified yet, but as soon as I know, I will definitely let everybody know for us to come together. And I hope that, you know, we'll be coming together to celebrate, but I just don't know we never know what happens in this situation. As I've told Mr. Adams many times, you never know when you wake up in the morning what's going to have happened with the Shannon and Modi situation, because there's a twist and turn, something you never in your wildest dreams thought would happen, happens. And I just keep hoping it's the release of Shannon. I keep hoping it is the release of Shannon Nyamudi. He has done nothing to warrant this treatment from Franklin County. Nothing. And they need to let him go.
Kim, can you tell us about this
Are you there?
What you're doing?
Say that again.
Yes. Can you tell us about what's going on this weekend? Well, what you're trying to do in the next 14 days?
Absolutely. So I just started a WOW movement. And the WOW movement is wellness, opportunity, and wonder. And what that movement is, it's really a movement for us to reach out and connect with our teens. I will empower 5,000 teens this year through our WOW movement. Our wellness is really telling them and teaching them about emotional literacy, opportunity, the opportunity for us to get every teen and young adult to unite. And then the wonder, youth will be empowered to see the wonders of the world and create wonders on their own. And so what's going on for me is that I'm asking everyone who hears the sound of my voice to please be so kind and go to our website, www.razzo.com/story/WOWMTS, and donate $10 for the cause, because we have a deadline by next Friday to raise $10,000. If not, then they will cancel our workshops. And we already know that in all of the communities throughout our nations, the first thing that they snatch away, that they take away, are the resources that are available for our teens and young adults. So I am pleading and asking if you would go to www.razzoo.com/story/WOWMTS and donate $10. So that's what's going on. I can't wait till next week to come on and tell you that we met our deadline and we met our goal. Thank you.
Is there a number? Phone number?
My telephone number, absolutely. 757-897-8964.
Very good. Thank you.
That's my cell.
I think we need to do some razzle dazzle with Shannon Namodi. Also, we need to do something. People need to be aware that anybody who's hearing the sound of my voice, why don't you just give the sheriff a call down in Franklin County and ask him what's going on with Shannon Namodi and see what he says. What's that phone number down there, David?
I haven't called. I haven't gotten that number. I'm afraid what I might say to him if I call down there. I think Beth Kruder might have that number.
Beth, do you have that number?
I don't have that number because I don't feel like being lied to my face. So
all you got to do is look up the sheriff of Franklin County, and his name is what?
Jerry Jones.
Oh, hey, it's not the Jerry Jones that I know in Texas. Owns the Dallas Cowboys, so I know that. That's my boy down there. So Jerry Jones in Franklin County, Mississippi Burning, Guantanamo, Northeast, Northwest. That's what it is. I want to thank everybody for part of the show today. I want to thank, and we're going to have a little bit of this old heart of mine, everybody needs to think about it. I want to thank everybody for being on the show today. Thank you for our caller. You're welcome to call back anytime. And remember, Shannon Namodi, find out everything you can and call that sheriff down there in Franklin County.
It might be your...
Thank you.
Memories that don't bring you back.